Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Nehemiah chapter 2, going to do verses 1 through 20. We'll call this chapter Nehemiah Inspects Jerusalem's Walls. Our context is this. In Nehemiah chapter 1, we see Nehemiah expressing his grief for the exiles because the city walls had been burnt down. The city walls of Jerusalem had been burnt down and the gates broken. Hanani, Nehemiah's brother, whoever that was, and some other friends had come back from Jerusalem and given him the bad news. That had happened in the month of Kislev, November to December, of either 445 or 444. Well, actually, it was 445, the 20th year of Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes ruling from 465 to 424. We read about that in Nehemiah 1:1 when Nehemiah got the bad news. Now, it was almost 4 months later when Nehemiah mentions his plight or his sadness, his grief about Jerusalem's walls to the king Artaxerxes. And we read about that in Nehemiah 2:1 as we begin. During the month of Nisan in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was set before him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had never been sad in his presence. And of course, the implication is he's sad in his presence now, for the first time. Now, this is in Nisan. That's the first month of the religious year, March through April. And this is about 4 months after Nehemiah had learned of the desolate state of Jerusalem through his brother Hanani. As I said, we read that in Nehemiah 1:1 during the month of Kislev, which is the ninth month. So if you go Kislev 9 and then go 10th month, 11th month, 12th month, first month of the next year, we've got 4 months. So 4 months. Now, why did Nehemiah take so long to tell of his pain to the Persian king Artaxerxes? Well, pulpit commentary gives us four possibilities. Perhaps the king Artaxerxes and his court were staying the winter at Babylon instead of Susa, where Nehemiah now was. Sometimes the Persian kings did that. And so maybe for 4 months, Nehemiah did not have access to Artaxerxes. Or option number two, maybe Nehemiah and Artaxerxes were in the same city, Susa, but maybe Nehemiah had not been called on to perform his cupbearer duties for 4 months. There could have been other cupbearers. Or option number three, Nehemiah may have been serving Artaxerxes as cupbearer, but Artaxerxes may not have noticed Nehemiah's grief. And of course, Nehemiah is not going to speak to the great king first. That was not his place to do so. Option number four, maybe Nehemiah had tried to conceal his grief, because Persian subjects were expected to be perfectly happy in the presence of their king. Well, if that were the case, Nehemiah took a chance and let his grief show on his face. Maybe he just couldn't hide it anymore, and Artaxerxes saw it. Before we go on, there's a brief problem here that I talked about in the last audio. Nehemiah is informed of the sad state of Jerusalem's walls in Kislev, November, December, and then 4 months later in Nisan of the next year, he talks to Artaxerxes about it. Well, if it's the next year, then that should be the 21st year of Artaxerxes. Because Nehemiah 1:1 says during the month of Kislev in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, he talks to Hanani, finds out about the situation. And then here in our verse in Nehemiah 2:1 during the month of Nisan in the 20th year, the same year. Well, how can it be the same year? Well, the answer is given by John Gill, who says that other nations besides Israel did not take Nisan as the first of the year. That's the Jewish religious year. The Jewish civil years, like other nations' civil year, Tishri is the first year, and Tishri hadn't rolled around yet. If you go from Kislev to Nisan, it's all in the same year, the 20th year of Artaxerxes, which would be 445. Or 444, depending on how you calculate. People give different dates. We go now to Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 2 through 3. So the king, that's Artaxerxes, said to Nehemiah, "Why are you sad when you aren't sick? This is nothing but depression. I was overwhelmed with fear and replied to the king, 'May the king live forever. Why should I not be sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?'" Well, Artaxerxes says, your sickness is nothing but depression. What he means is, it has nothing to do with physical sickness, according to John Gill. You're not sick. Why are you sad when you aren't sick? You must be depressed emotionally. Now, when Nehemiah heard that, he was overwhelmed with fear. He says at the end of verse 2. Now, why would Nehemiah be afraid? Well, here's some options. One, Artaxerxes might think Nehemiah was planning a coup, as Gill and Clark suggest. Because if you're planning a coup d'etat, your nerves are going to be on edge, and the king, Artaxerxes, might have thought that Nehemiah's nerves were showing, and Artaxerxes might look at Nehemiah and says, this man is up to no good because he's nervous. And Nehemiah might have realized that the king was thinking that, and that might have made him afraid. Or it could be, as John Gill suggests, option number two as to why Nehemiah was afraid. He could have been afraid that Artaxerxes would not accede to Nehemiah's request. Why might Artaxerxes, why would he possibly not agree to Nehemiah's request? Well, for one thing, the request might be considered too large. Go back and rebuild walls to make Jerusalem a fortified city. And you know what I, King Artaxerxes, think about fortified cities. That's how people start revolts. So that might have made Nehemiah afraid. Or perhaps Artaxerxes was afraid because he knew that there were enemies of the Jews all around the king, Persian officials who weren't happy with Jews. And so he was afraid to ask in front of these enemies, to ask for help to go fix the walls of Jerusalem. Here's option number three is why he might have been afraid. This is according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. It was deemed highly unbecoming for Persian officials to appear in the royal presence with signs of sorrow. We know about this Persian custom from Esther 4:2. He, referring to Mordecai, Esther's relative, Mordecai only went as far as the king's gate since the law prohibited anyone wearing sackcloth from entering the king's gate. Persian emperors did not want to be reminded of the ills of mankind. So anyway, there's a lot of reasons why Nehemiah could have been afraid. And so he starts out in response to Artaxerxes by saying, "Long live the king." Well, he didn't say long live the king. He said, "May the king live forever," which in my translation here, Holman Christian Study Bible, is the same thing as saying, "May long live the king," which is a stock standard phrase that shows loyalty, obedience to the monarch. He may have said that because he wanted to allay suspicion on Artaxerxes' part that there might be a coup brewing. Nehemiah continues talking to Artaxerxes. He says, "Of course I'm sad. The city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins." Now, why mention the fact that his ancestors are buried in Jerusalem? Well, as John Gill points out, where one's ancestors are buried was a big deal in ancient times. And so Nehemiah is trying to get Artaxerxes to feel his pain. We go down to Nehemiah 2, verses 4 through 5. "Then the king, Artaxerxes, asked me, Nehemiah, 'What is your request?' So I prayed to the God of heaven and answered the king, 'If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor with you, send me to Judah and to the city where my ancestors are buried,'" he mentions that again, "'so that I may rebuild it.'" In verse 4, the king says, "What is your request?" Artaxerxes, from what Nehemiah had said, figured that Nehemiah was getting ready to ask him something. That's not surprising. Notice that Nehemiah immediately prayed. Now, he couldn't have gone into his prayer closet, gotten on his knees, laid down his prayer rug, pulled out his scriptures, folded his hands. He was on the spot. He prayed a quick, silent prayer in his heart, as Adam Clark says. And John Gill says perhaps this was a prayer of thanksgiving as well as supplication. I think it was mostly supplication. All of a sudden, Nehemiah thinks, after 4 months of waiting, it looks like Artaxerxes might turn a favorable eye to my request. Now, this is a good application here. Sometimes you can't prepare to pray. Sometimes, for example, you get a hard question on an exam and you say, "Oh my gosh, I can't answer that. I didn't study that. What am I going to do?" And that's when you start praying silently, fervently, in the midst of the battle. Now, Nehemiah asked Artaxerxes for permission to go back to Judah so that Nehemiah may rebuild the city. So that means not only the wall, but the houses in the city as well. We tend to think of Nehemiah and walls, but it was more than just the walls. It was the city itself. He mentions the fact that this city was where his ancestors are buried. I've already mentioned that the tombs of the dead were sacred among the ancients. Adam Clark points out that mentioning this would strongly move a Persian king. That would resonate with him. because that's the way people thought back then. We go to Nehemiah 2, verse 6. The king, with the queen seated beside him, asked Nehemiah, how long will your journey take, and when will you return? So I gave him a definite time, and it pleased the king to send me. Now, the queen is mentioned here sitting by Artaxerxes I. And by the way, I haven't said this in these audios. Artaxerxes I, who ruled from 465 to 424, his moniker was Longimanus, Longhand. Artaxerxes Longhand. I don't know why he was called that. I mention that because the name is used a lot, especially when we get to Daniel. Artaxerxes I only had one legitimate wife. Her name was Damaspia. The only thing that's known about Damaspia is that she died on the same day as the king. When I read that, I wondered, did she die naturally, or did somebody bump her off? I suspect the latter, although I don't know. Now, Persian kings did not allow their queens to be present at state festivals, but here the queen was seated beside the king, so this must have been a private dinner, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out. And as the pulpit commentary points out, it was not an unusual circumstance for the queen to sit by the king when there's a private meal. First thing Artaxerxes asked Nehemiah is, how long is this going to take? Well, that shows that the king was loath to part with Nehemiah's services. Nehemiah must have been doing a good job, and we need to remember that if you want to ask favor of those in power, there's nothing better. There's no better calling card than to do a good job. Daniel did a good job when he was in exile in Babylon and also Persia. He was a good government official. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that Nehemiah was in high favor at court, so that high favor helped him get a favorable answer from Artaxerxes. And of course, God was behind this all sovereignly, like he always is. Now, the pulpit commentary speculates that Nehemiah probably told Artaxerxes that he, Nehemiah, would be back in a year or two. That would allow him enough time for the double journey there and back, and also time to fix the walls. It actually took 52 days to fix the walls, so that would be right, about a year or two. But he ended up staying for 12 years. We know that because we read in Nehemiah 5:14, furthermore, from the day King Artaxerxes appointed me to be their governor in the land of Judah, he's talking about Nehemiah, from the 20th year until his 32nd year, 12 years, I and my associates never ate from the food allotted to the governor. So he was in Jerusalem for 12 years. Now, he could have gone in 445/444. He could have gone then. That's what we're talking about now. That's when he was talking to Artaxerxes. He could have gone, spent a year or two, and then come back, and then return for his 12-year service. Cambridge commentator says the existence of this unstated return trip is, quote-unquote, much disputed. Well, I don't know how you're going to solve that, because it doesn't say. It's silent about whether he went and came back. I'm just going to assume he went and stayed for 12 years. The pulpit commentator says if he did that, he probably kept asking Artaxerxes I for extensions. Oh, great king, I've been here for a year, but things are tough. I need to stay a little bit longer. Oh, great king, how about let me stay for 4 more years, and that kind of thing. Now, it's interesting that even though the wall was completed in 52 days, Nehemiah ended up staying for 12 years. How do we know it took 52 days? Nehemiah 6:15. The wall was completed in 52 days on the 25th day of the month Elul. Well, after that 12 years, we arrive at 433 B.C. because if you take 445, which is the rough date, 445/444, let's say 445 minus 12, that gets you to 433. If it's 444 minus 12, that gets you to 432. Now, 432 is roughly the time that Nehemiah went back to Jerusalem the second time. We read about that in Nehemiah 13, verses 6 through 7. While all this was happening, I was not in Jerusalem, because I had returned to King Artaxerxes of Babylon in the 32nd year of his reign. His reign started in 465. 465 minus 32 is 433, which is close enough to 432. It was only later that I asked the king for a leave of absence so I could return to Jerusalem. So he goes back the second time in 432 or so, 433/432. Right, there's our time frame for Nehemiah's trips to Jerusalem. We go now to Nehemiah 2, verse 7. I also said to the king, we're now back in 444, or 445, I also said to the king, King Artaxerxes, if it pleases the king, let me have letters written to the governors of the region west of the Euphrates River so that they will grant me safe passage until I reach Judah. Now, the governors of the region west of the Euphrates River would include the governors of Syria, Aram, Phoenicia, Samaria, the former northern Israel. It would include the Ammonites. It would include the Moabites and maybe even some Arabians there in the Arabian Desert. So Persia was in charge of all these regions. So Nehemiah wants safe passage. He also wanted provisions and he wanted a guard. He will get those provisions. He will get that guard from Artaxerxes. The governors of the region west of the Euphrates River is a very famous river, of course, but it's also the natural dividing line between the eastern and western part of the Persian Empire. It was also the furthest extent of the Roman Empire later on in history. It's a very famous river. One needs to learn the geography around that river very badly if one wants to understand ancient Near Eastern history and including biblical history. We go down to Nehemiah 2:8. I'm going to use God's Word translation here for a reason. Also, let me have a letter addressed to Asaph. Nehemiah continues, Artaxerxes, let me have a letter addressed to Asaph, the supervisor of your majesty's forest. In the letter, order him to give me wood for the gates of the fortress near the temple, for the city wall, and for the house I'll move into. The king let me have the letters because God was guiding me. Now Asaph is the supervisor of the king of Persia's forest, Artaxerxes' forest. What forest is he talking about? It has to be the forest of Lebanon, that famous forest up there on the Phoenician coast. John Gill says, because of its odoriferous and fruit-bearing trees, it was more like an orchard or paradise. In fact, the phrase there, your majesty's forest, literally means paradise of the king. And of course, why did it belong to the king? Because Lebanon or Phoenicia was under the jurisdiction of Persia. Now, the wood that Nehemiah was going to use was for the gates of the fortress near the temple. Now, what is this fortress near the temple? Well, a couple of options. John Gill says it's the gates of the courtyard around the temple, not the fortress near the temple. I don't think that's right. Most of the translations, however, are very confusing. That's why I use God's Word translation here, because that translation says that this is a fortress near the temple. The New American Bible says it's the temple citadel. Well, the Cambridge Commentary says that this fortress near the temple later became the famous Antonia Fortress, or Antonia Fortress, on the north side of the temple courtyard. And of course, that's where the Apostle Paul got arrested one time in the latter part of the book of Acts. Very famous place. It's still there. They'll point it out to you if you go on a tour. Well, here it is. Nehemiah is looking for wood for that fortress. The Antonia Temple Fortress was called that because Herod the Great named, he built it, and he named it after his buddy Mark Antony. Now, the wood would not only build this fortress, but also the gates that are mentioned here in verse 8 of Nehemiah 2. But not only the gates, but the towers above the gates. If you think about a gate in an ancient city wall, there was the outer gate of the wall, there was the inner gate, and there's maybe 6 feet or so, maybe more than that, I don't know. There's a hallway between the outer and the inner gate. That hallway was covered with a roof, and on top of that roof, there were rooms above the gate. So the gates were a big deal. Of course, they're all broken down now, but there's a lot of wood that would be needed to build these gates. Now, in verse 8, the wood is said by Nehemiah to be used for the city wall. That doesn't mean for the wall, because the wall is going to be made out of stone. It's the wood for the gates in the city wall. Also, he needs wood for the house he'll move into. The house would be Nehemiah's official state residence, as the Cambridge Commentary points out. Now, this last phrase, unfortunately, is not translated well by God's Word translation. The king let me have the letters because God was guiding me. That's so vanilla. God was guiding me. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates it this way, for I was graciously strengthened by my God. Well, that puts a stronger flavor to it, does it not? Now, Adam Clark mentions that Nehemiah is modest because he doesn't mention his faithful, skillful service to the Persian king as the reason why the king gave him those letters, those official letters. But of course, that did enter into Artaxerxes' decision, but Nehemiah did mention that. He lets God get the credit for it. God was graciously guiding me and graciously strengthening me. Two things Nehemiah gave God the credit for. Number one, the favorable disposition of Artaxerxes. And number two, the success of his mission, which hasn't happened yet, but it will. He'll give God the credit then. We go now to Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. I, Nehemiah, went to the governors of the region west of the Euphrates, that's the Samaritans, the Syrians, the Phoenicians, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Arabians. I went to the governors of the region west of the Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. The king had also sent officers of the infantry and cavalry with me. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard that someone had come to seek the well-being of the Israelites, they were greatly displeased. Artaxerxes had given Nehemiah a military escort, infantry and cavalry, foot soldiers and horse soldiers. Why? Well, for a great honor, but also to protect Nehemiah as he went on his journey. Well, that's a long trip. Nehemiah needed military support. Now, these two officials, these are working under the Persian Empire. The first is Sanballat the Horonite. He was governor of Samaria. Nehemiah 4:1-2 says this, "When Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became furious. He mocked the Jews before his colleagues and the powerful men of Samaria." So even though he was originally from Horon, wherever that was, he was now in charge of the northern kingdom of Samaria under the Persians. Now, Horonaim, or Horon, is the name of Sanballat's hometown. Well, I think most people, for example, Gil Clark and Jameson Fawcett and Brown, say that Horon is a city of Moab. It's mentioned in Isaiah 15:5, "My heart cries out over Moab, whose fugitives flee as far as Zoar, to Eglath-Chelishiya. They go up to the slope of Luhith weeping. They raise a cry of destruction on the road to Horonaim." My heart cries out over Moab and Horonaim. Both are mentioned in Isaiah 15:5. And if you look at the map, we will see, this is BibleAtlas.org. If you look at the Dead Sea, you're east of the Dead Sea in Moab, south of the Arnon River, and right midway between the Arnon and Zered at the far south of Moab, right about halfway you see Horonaim. However, it has a question mark. They're not sure. They haven't actually found it yet. That's just speculation. Now, this Sanballat is an interesting character. Josephus says that he actually met Alexander the Great and asked Alexander the Great to build the famous Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim. Remember, the Samaritan woman told Jesus, "Our ancestors worship at this temple here." She was at Shechem, which is right in the valley between, well, she was at Sychar, which is right next to Shechem, which is in the valley between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And so this was a competitor temple to the true Jewish temple in Jerusalem. Sanballat is said by Josephus to have asked Alexander the Great to build that temple. And some people have followed Josephus in that idea, but it can't be that, because Alexander was over 100 years later. He died in 323, and we are now in 444 or so. It's over 100 years later. Can't be. Well, I found an interesting website concerning this issue of who built that Samaritan temple. The website is www.antiquities.org, and this website says that Sanballat was, quote-unquote, with certainty, the builder of the first phase of Mount Gerizim's temple. And they cite archaeological digs done since 1982, and they say that those archaeological digs prove it. Interesting. Of course, I'm not an expert on archaeology, so I can't say for sure whether this website is accurate or not, but if they are, that would really be interesting. Sanballat did this. And this same website, antiquities.org, says that Horon, where Sanballat was from, was not in Moab, like most everybody says, but it was rather at the foot of Mount Gerizim. I can't vouch for that either, but I run it by you for your interest. We go now to Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 11 through 12. "After I arrived in Jerusalem and had been there 3 days, I got up at night and took a few men with me. I didn't tell anyone what my God had laid on my heart to do for Jerusalem. The only animal I took was the one I was riding." Now, Nehemiah rested for 3 days after he got there. That's Well, it doesn't say he rested. It just said he had been there 3 days before he got up to take a night trip around the walls, but he was probably resting, as John Gill suggests. Ezra did the same thing when he arrived in 458. This is Ezra 8, verse 32. So we arrived at Jerusalem and rested there for 3 days. And so Nehemiah probably did the same thing. Now, the trip from Susa to Jerusalem is about 900 miles. This is from a website called cyclinghikes.com. Not exactly a scholarly website, but I have no reason to doubt what they say. They also say it would take 4 or 5 months to make the trip. That's a long trip. No wonder they rested for 3 days. Now, why did he go out at night to inspect the walls? Well, it was for greater secrecy, as John Gill says. To rebuild a city's wall is a political statement. It means we are now fortified and we can resist sieges and we're going to quit paying you tribute. Now, for that reason, it would not do for Sanballat and Tobiah, the two Samaritan officials, to hear about this and to report it to the Persian king. That would stir up trouble. Of course, the Persian king already knows what Nehemiah's doing, but still, you don't want the officials to get riled up. So Nehemiah went secretly. He also took a few men with him. A few men, that's for greater secrecy. If he had taken a big company with him, it would have roused attention. He also didn't take a lot of animals, which would also make a lot of noise and arouse attention. He only took one animal. It's probably a mule. Everybody else walked. Well, why was it only Nehemiah that rode and everybody else walked? Well, John Gill says it's because he was the king's official. He needed to have honor. Honor in the eyes of the other officials, the few men who were with him. It could have been that Nehemiah needed rest. He may have been tired from the journey, as John Gill says. We go now to Nehemiah 2:13. I went out at night through the valley gate toward the serpent's well and the dung gate, and I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that had been broken down and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. Now, these gates in the time of Nehemiah are not fixed with certainty. You can look at different images, as I've done, and they all differ a little bit in various places. And it actually doesn't really matter, except as a matter of historical interest, where these gates were. But I'm going to use what I found to be the best diagram of the gates of Jerusalem during Nehemiah's time. This is from a place called Bible History Online. We see in verse 13 that Nehemiah went out through the valley gate. Well, if you look at Jerusalem, the walls all the way around Jerusalem, and on the eastern side of Jerusalem, you'll see Mount Zion, which looks like the state of California, coming to a peak there. Tarpeian Valley on the west, Kidron Valley on the east, coming to a peak. Go south a little bit further than that, and you get the Valley of Hinnom, which surrounds the city on the southern side. Now, if you go southwest of Mount Zion, across the Tarpeian Valley, back into what is called the Southwest Ridge, right there on the southwestern corner of Jerusalem is the Valley Gate. It opens straight out into the Valley of Hinnom, which wraps around from the northwest to the southwest to the south of Jerusalem, the place where the dead bodies were buried, where the trash was burnt, where people offered their kids to Tophet, I think his name was, the idol there that required children for sacrifice, the famous Valley of Hinnom, also known as Gehenna, which Jesus used as a description of hell. So he starts out there in the Valley Gate at the southwest corner, and then he proceeds eastward along the southern edge of the wall, and he goes all the way to the Dung Gate. Now, the Dung Gate is at the southeastern corner of the city walls. The Dung Gate is right south of the famous Pool of Siloam. My map has the Pool of Siloam and the lower pool right there as you go into the Dung Gate, into the city walls, right there at the southwest corner. I think some people think the Pool of Siloam is the lower pool. They're both together. My map has them separated out. I'm not sure about that. But at any rate, as you are at the Pool of Siloam and go north a little bit, you have an inner wall that surrounds Mount Zion, which is that strip of land that looks like the state of California between the Tarpeian and the Kidron Valley. It comes to a point right there. At that point, outside the inner wall that's around Mount Zion, right south of that inner wall, and then right in the eastern wall there, is the Fountain Gate. So the Valley Gate, Dung Gate, and Fountain Gate, I think all three of those are going to be mentioned here. The Fountain Gate in verse 14, which we haven't gotten to yet, but the Valley Gate and the Dung Gate are mentioned. So, basically, what we have is Nehemiah going out of the southwest wall through the valley gate, going along the southern wall until he gets to the dung gate, and then going along until he gets to the fountain gate a little bit further to the north as he ascends up the eastern wall of Jerusalem. Those three gates are mentioned. I think those are pretty standard. I don't think there's much disagreement on that. Now, in verse 13, the valley gate is said to be toward the serpent's well. I think that's been lost to history. The Holman Christian Study Bible says it could be called the dragon's well as well as the serpent's well. Here's some speculations on where the name came from. Perhaps the well wound about like a serpent. Perhaps there was a dragon through whose mouth the water came out of the well. Or another option, maybe since 586 when the Babylonians burnt the city down, serpents had taken up their residence in the area because they weren't people. Snakes don't like people, I know, because I live in the country. And there were snakes everywhere when we got out here, but I haven't seen one in years because they don't like us living here, which is fine with me. But anyway, this serpent's well was there. Now, Nehemiah says he inspected the walls of Jerusalem. Now, you might ask, how can he inspect the walls of Jerusalem? It's in the middle of the night. Well, it must have been a moonlit night so he could see. I mean, I'm out in the country, and when the new moon is shining out here, you can see just about like it's broad daylight. They couldn't carry torches, as John Gill points out, because they would have been spotted, and that would have destroyed their secrecy. Now, I've already mentioned this in a previous audio, but I'll mention again about these walls that had been broken down. When had they been broken down? There's much debate about that. They could have been torn down by the Babylonians in 586, and that's what Nehemiah was looking at, the results of that 586 destruction. It's about a century and a half earlier. Or it could be that in 536, when the Jews had returned in 538 and laid the temple foundation in 536, they could have begun to rebuild the walls when they rebuilt the temple foundation. Some people speculate that. And there's a couple of options. If they started rebuilding the wall in 536, they could have not finished the rebuilding because of opposition from their Samaritan neighbors, and then the wall therefore remained in ruins. Or they could have finished rebuilding in 536, and then the pagan neighbors came down and destroyed it. All speculation. Some people speculate that the Jews finished completing the walls when they finished the temple in 516, and then the Samaritans came and knocked the walls down. Some people speculate it could be even later, between the returns of Ezra in 458 BC and Nehemiah in 444 BC, that the Jews had built the walls up and then the Samaritans had knocked them down. Well, it doesn't matter. The walls were busted up. One little small point before I leave verse 13. The dung gate, that's the gate in the very southeastern extremity of the city of Jerusalem. The reason it was called dung gate is because dung was carried out of the city into the valley of Hinnom, the trash dump right in, to the south there. A common sewer ran through the dung gate to the brook Kidron, and then from the Kidron to the valley of Hinnom. The Kidron and Tyrepean valleys come together at a point right south of Mount Zion, and then the Valley of Hinnom is to the south of that point, and so the garbage, the poop, had to go through the dung gate, and then it had to go through the Kidron Valley to the east there, right near the tip, the confluence of the Tyrepean and the Kidron Valley. The dung gate would go through the tip there, and then further south to the Hinnom Valley. Appropriate. We go down to Nehemiah 2, verses 14 through 15. I went on to the fountain gate and the king's pool. Now, as I said earlier, the fountain gate is just the next gate up north. Well, actually, it's a little bit northeast, but let's just say north of the dung gate. You get to the fountain gate, which is right before the double wall there. You got the outer wall, and then you got the inner wall that surrounds Mount Zion. And right outside of that inner wall is the Pool of Siloam, the famous Pool of Siloam, which is connected through Hezekiah's tunnel to the Gihon Spring, which is a little bit further to the north, to the east of the wall, outside of the wall, in the Kidron Valley. But Hezekiah's tunnel took the water from that spring and went underground, where no enemy could get it, under the wall, through the wall, through two walls, actually, the two walls at the southern tip of Mount Zion, and then into the Pool of Siloam. Well, the fountain gate is right in the middle of all that, right to the south of Hezekiah's tunnel, right to the south of the tip of Mount Zion, right to the east of the Pool of Siloam. So Jeremiah goes to that fountain gate. I'm assuming he's on the outside of the wall as he inspects it. It doesn't say, but I'm assuming that's what it was. Farther down the valley, Kidron Valley, it became too narrow for my animal to go through, probably because of refuse and stuff piled there. Came too narrow for his animal to go through, so I went up at night by way of the valley, in other words, outside of the wall, and inspected the wall. I might have said that a little bit confusingly, so let me say it again. He probably went through the dung gate and went inside the wall by the lower pool, the Pool of Siloam, and then things got too crowded for him, so he went back out the fountain gate and went along the outside of the eastern wall. This is all speculation on my part. It's probably speculation on everybody's part. At any rate, he returns from the fountain gate and goes back to the valley gate, which if he retraced his steps, he would go south to the dung gate at the southeast corner of the wall, and then he would go due west until he got to the valley gate at the southwest corner of the wall. However, I think most people say, at least Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, that what he did was he continued on going north all along the outside of the wall, past Ophel, past the Horse Gate, past the Corner Gate, past the Tower of Mia in the north, past the Tower of Hananeel. Now he's coming back down south on the western side, by the Mishnah Gate, by the Tower of the Furnaces, all the way down the western wall, until he gets back to the Valley Gate. So he would have a full circuit of the wall to inspect it. I think that makes more sense. If you're going to inspect the wall, you ought to do it all. Clark and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown agree with that sentiment. We go now to Nehemiah 2, verse 16. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, for I had not yet told the Jews, priests, nobles, officials, or the rest of those who would be doing the work. Now, the officials who did not know where Nehemiah had gone were probably officers of the king of Persia who were ruling Jerusalem at the time. Now, there would be Jewish officials there too, but the Persians are probably not going to let the Jews rule it all by themselves. So these officials that are mentioned that were kept in the dark were probably Persian officials, but it wasn't only them that were kept in the dark. Nehemiah says, I had not told the Jews, and the Jews he had not told would be the priest, the nobles, those are probably cultural, financial big shots, officials, those are probably the Jewish officials, political officials, the priest, of course, being the religious officials of the Jews. So neither Persian nor Jew knew what Nehemiah had done. This was Nehemiah operating solely on his own top secret mission. We go to Nehemiah 2, verses 17 through 18. So I, Nehemiah, said to all those officials I just mentioned, you see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned down. Come, let's rebuild Jerusalem's wall, so that we will no longer be a disgrace. I told them how the gracious hand of my God had been on me, and what the king had said to me. They said, let's start rebuilding, and they were encouraged to do this good work. So Nehemiah tells the Persian and Jewish officials, look, you see what we got here? The walls have been burnt down. The gates have been burnt down. Jerusalem's in ruins. That's the same thing that Jeremiah's brother Hanani and his friends had said to Jeremiah, to Nehemiah back in Nehemiah 1 verse 3. They, referring to Hanani and friends, said to Nehemiah, the remnant in the province who survived the exile are in great trouble and disgrace. Jerusalem's wall has been broken down and its gates have been burned down. So we're less than a year later, maybe a year later, and they're still burnt down and things are still bad. Notice how Nehemiah says that the burnt down walls are a disgrace. And Hanani back in Susa, when he saw Nehemiah, he told Nehemiah that the exiles in Jerusalem are in great trouble and disgrace. People are looking down on them. You're living in a shanty town, so let's build the wall. Verse 18, Nehemiah refers to the gracious hand of his God that had been on him. How was that manifested? Because God had moved Artaxerxes to let Nehemiah come to Jerusalem. That's how the good hand of God had been on Nehemiah. Well, the people were encouraged when they heard that, so they said, yeah, let's rebuild the wall. They knew that now Yahweh was behind the project, and also the king of Persia, Artaxerxes, was behind the project. And so, of course, they want to build the wall. We go down to Nehemiah 2, verses 19 through 20, and we will finish this audio. When Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about this, they mocked and despised us and said, what is this you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king? I gave them this reply. The God of heaven is the one who will grant us success. We, his servants, will start building, but you have no share, right, or historic claim in Jerusalem. Now, again, to get our time frame, I'm going to assume that 445 is when in Susa, Nehemiah went to Artaxerxes. And now, after the trip over and the inspection of the walls and the getting ready to build the wall and such, we'll assume it's about 444 now. Now the Samaritans, and I'm going to call them the Samaritans from now on, the Persian officials who are ruling the province of Samaria to the north, they find out about it. Of course, they're going to find out about the wall being built. That's not going to take long. Their response was mockery and looking down on the Israelites. And they asked, they sent somebody to Nehemiah and says, what is this you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king? We're building a city wall. That's the classic thing to do if you want to rebel against the king. So that's actually a logical thing to ask. Now these two officials, well, that's actually three, Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arab. I've already mentioned Sanballat the Horonite. He apparently is the guy that started building the famous rival temple on Mount Gerizim near Shechem in the north. He was probably from Moab because that's where Horon was, or Horonaim. Tobiah was from Ammon. They're from those places, but they've moved to Samaria to run the Samaritan province for the Persians. Geshem the Arab, when you hear Arab, that's anywhere between, say, Damascus and the Euphrates River in the north, going all the way south between the Jordan and Euphrates River. Keep going south till you get down into Saudi Arabia and go all the way down to the Indian Ocean, down to Kuwait and Yemen, all the way down there. All of that area is the Arabian Desert. We tend to think only of the southern part, Saudi Arabia, as being the Arabian Desert, but no, it goes all the way up to Damascus. In fact, Paul said he went into the Arabian Desert after his conversion at Damascus. That used to confuse me. I said, the Arabian Desert, that's way down in Saudi Arabia. Well, no, it went all the way up to Damascus. Well, anyway, this Geshem was somewhere from Arabia. Not very important. That was a huge rabbit trail I just went on. In verse 20, we see Nehemiah's reply. He didn't hesitate a minute. He wasn't intimidated one little bit. He said, the God of heaven is the one who will grant us success. Don't start making fun of me, boy. Don't start making fun of me, you big shot Samaritans. We, Nehemiah continues, Yahweh's servants, we're going to start building. But you, Samaritans, you have no share, no right, or historic claim in Jerusalem. You do not live here in Jerusalem. You don't own any part of the city here in Jerusalem. You don't have any jurisdiction here under the Persians over Jerusalem. That jurisdiction belongs to me, Nehemiah. Artaxerxes I, the king of Persia, gave it to me. You don't have any ancestors who lived here. Remember, the Samaritans were a polyglot population that had been imported into the empire by the Assyrians in 722 when the northern Israelites fell to Sargon II, the Assyrian king. So their ancestors didn't own any property there. They had nothing to do with Jerusalem, but they're going to give them hassles. Why? Because they didn't want Jerusalem to become a powerful city in the Persian Empire because it would overshadow them in Samaria. Now, what these Samaritan officials were going to do, Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, they were going to report to Artaxerxes and say, look, you told them they could build the wall, but they're not just building a wall. They're getting ready to rebel against you and not pay their tribute anymore. Why would the Samaritan officials go to such extremes to oppose the Jews? Well, for one thing, it was their taxes that were going to pay for Jerusalem, and I think they got a legitimate gripe there. I can't remember which two Persian kings actually in their decrees actually said taxes would go for paying for Jerusalem. I don't have the site in front of me, but I know it's there. And so that would make the Samaritans a little bit upset, and they perhaps were worried that the legal jurisdiction over Samaria was going to be given to the Jews when the Jews had this big fancy city of Jerusalem rebuilt. And then they might be thinking Artaxerxes is going to say, okay, Jerusalem's obviously the big city in the area, so we're going to put Samaria under the jurisdiction of the Jerusalemites. And you know what people think about losing power. Ask Nancy Pelosi. So that's why they were opposing Jeremiah. And Jeremiah, in effect, told the Samaritan officials, go mind your own business. We're going to build anyway. I don't care what you say. You haven't got any right down here. That's exactly what Zerubbabel had told the Samaritans earlier. This was after the Jews' first return in 538, which was almost 100 years earlier. When the first returning exiles came back, we read in Ezra 4:3, but Zerubbabel was the political leader, Jeshua was the religious leader of Israel, the high priest, and the other leaders of Israel's families answered the Samaritans, "You may have no part with us in building a house for our God, since we alone must build it for Yahweh, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us." In other words, buzz off, Samaritans. We don't want to have anything to do with you. We don't want your help, and we don't want... That was Ezra saying, Zerubbabel and Jeshua saying, "We don't want your help in building the temple." And here, Nehemiah says, "We don't care about your opposition in building the walls." So, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Nehemiah chapter 2. In our next audio, we will go to Nehemiah 3. We will cover verses 1 through 32, and we will look at the process of rebuilding the wall. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.